I have a program on my website which gives me a little bit of information about who comes and visits it and has a look at it. So it tells me from which country they come and a little bit, you know, how long they spent looking at the website and things like that. It also tracks what are the most popular searches. You recognize on the internet, if you want to find something out, you type in a search and it comes up with all sorts of answers. And the program tracks the most popular searches. And for a long time, top of the list has been Damascus will be a ruinous heap. What they found on my website, well, one or two articles and a rather dated article by David Dolan I put on it some time ago. But there's a few bits of information. But people are searching. Damascus will be a ruinous heap. They want to know what the future of Syria and Damascus is. And while the Syrian civil war has raged, it's been a subject of great interest. One of the reasons for searching this is that there is a prophecy in the book of Isaiah, which we'll now turn to. Isaiah 17, verses 1 to 3. Isaiah 17, verse 1. The burden against Damascus. Behold, Damascus will cease from being a city, and it will be a ruinous heap. The cities of Arur are forsaken. They will be for flocks which lie down, and no one will make them afraid. The fortress also will cease from Ephraim, the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria. They will be as the glory of the children of Israel, says the Lord of hosts. So that's where it comes from, this prophecy. One day, Damascus will be a ruinous heap. But it's important for us, if we're studying prophecy, to answer a basic question, which is, has that prophecy already been fulfilled, or is it now a future prophecy which we expect to be fulfilled in this present time? See, Damascus is possibly the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. It was certainly founded in the 3rd millennium BC, and it enters Bible history very early on. If you go back to Genesis 14, you'll find the first mention of Damascus in the Bible. Genesis 14 is about Abraham's nephew Lot, who you remember chose to go down and live in the Jordan Valley, which was very lush and, you know, ideal for him to rear his flocks and things. So he chose to go down to the Jordan Valley. But going down to the Jordan Valley, Lot gets mixed up in the politics of the Jordan Valley. And the cities of the Jordan Valley rebel against their overlords, who are the kings of the east. And to put that right, those kings come and attack the cities, Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities. And they take the people captive. And among those people, they take Lot captive. And therefore, Abraham is now drawn into the conflict. He's not down in that part of the world, but he's drawn in because he has to go and rescue his nephew, Lot. And so if we go to verse 15, talking about Abraham, he divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants attacked them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. I'm quoting that really just to show that by the time of Abraham, Damascus was an established city. It was already there. In fact, Abraham, on his travels from Ur of the Chaldees round to the Promised Land, almost certainly went round what is called the Fertile Crescent, the very fertile crescent of land north of Iraq and down into Syria and into Israel. If he went that route, he would have almost certainly gone through Damascus as he was travelling towards the Promised Land. And in chapter 15, verse 2, we find that it mentions his steward, verse 15, verse 2, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. So in travelling to Damascus, he seems to have employed Eliezer to come with him as his steward of his flocks and his possessions. So it enters Bible history very early on. We know from the Bible that it's already a thriving city by the time of Abraham. We'll jump ahead 1,000 years to 2 Samuel 8, verses 5 and 6, which I think is the next mention of Damascus. I may be wrong, but I think that is. 2 Samuel 8, verse 5. Then the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah. David killed 22,000 of the Syrians. Then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians became David's servants and brought tribute. So the Lord preserved David wherever he went. So King David, when the Syrians come to the aid of one of David's enemies, David defeats them, and it says he put a garrison in Damascus. So that's the next time we come across Damascus in Syria. David conquers it, and it's part of his kingdom for a time. But it seems that he didn't hold on to it for long, because we go then to 1 Kings 11, verse 23. And we're now into the time of the reign of King Solomon. So 1 Kings 11, 23. And God raised up another adversary against him, Rezin the son of Eliada, who had fled from his lord, Hadadezer, king of Zobah. So he gathered men to him and became captain over a band of raiders. When David killed those of Zobah, they went to Damascus and dwelt there and reigned in Damascus. He was an adversary of Israel all the days of Solomon, besides the trouble that Hadad had caused. And he abhorred Israel and reigned over Syria. So after David, during the time of Solomon, we have Rezin taking over Damascus. Whether Israel still had a garrison in Damascus, I don't know. But Rezin establishes that as his city, and he becomes more and more powerful, as we see. Move on a bit. 20 years after Solomon's death, great-grandson Asa has become king of Judah. And Asa foolishly forms an alliance with Ben-Hadad, who is also grandson of Rezin, this king who took over Damascus during the reign of Solomon. He's grandson to him. So Asa forms an alliance with Ben-Hadad of Syria to defeat Israel, who are attacking. The kingdoms are separated now into Israel and Judah, two separate kingdoms. And Israel is attacking Judah. So if we go to 1 Kings 15, verses 18 and 19... So remember, this is grandson of Solomon, 20 years after Solomon's death. Then Asa took all the silver and gold that was left in the treasuries of the house of the Lord and the treasuries of the king's house, and delivered them into the hand of his servants. And King Asa sent them to Ben-Hadad, the son of Tabrimon, the son of Hezion, king of Syria, who dwelt in Damascus, saying, "Let there be a treaty between you and me, as there was between my father and your father. See, I have sent you a present of silver and gold. Come and break your treaty with Baasha, king of Israel, so that he will withdraw from me." In another talk, I've gone through all the times that Israel makes alliances with other powers, only to find about 50 years later that power they make the alliance with comes back and attacks them. It always fails. When it says the gold and silver left in the temple of the Lord, you have to remember at this time, in the time of Rehoboam, Solomon's son, Pharaoh from Egypt had come up against Israel and taken away all the treasures that Solomon had built up. So most of it had already gone to Egypt. But Solomon's grandson still rakes around and finds enough treasure to send off to Syria, to Ben-Hadad, to form an alliance with Syria, to release him from the attacks of Israel. A very interesting comment also about this forming alliances. If you go to 2 Chronicles 16, and we won't spend a lot of time there, we have the Lord's verdict on Asa's actions, and the Lord is cross with Asa. You see, because previously to this, Asa has been threatened by a huge army of Ethiopians. 1 million men had come up against Judah, and it says in that chapter that in Chronicles 14, sorry, two chapters earlier, that Asa cried out to the Lord, and the Lord rescues him. But now, this time, instead of trying out for the Lord to be rescued, he tries to buy the enemy off. And the prophet comes and tells him, for this reason, you are not going to escape. You're going to have war, war, war. Because instead of looking to God, you took earthly means. Just a little warning to us. You know, sometimes we have a great answer to prayer, and the Lord intervenes into our lives, and we give him the glory. And then a few weeks later, we're trying to sort it all out ourselves in our own way. A little bit of warning, you know, God's not pleased, actually. If he's proved that he's reliable, you can trust him, you can bring your petitions to him, and he will answer. He expects you to carry on trusting him. And he was cross with Asa, because Asa tries to buy off Israel and by getting the Assyrians to attack them. And for another 200 years, there now is conflict between Syria and Israel and Judah. That's the price of what he's paid. So we go on in history, and this history lesson does get to a point in the end, but we're going on another period of time into 765 BC. That was 931 BC. 765 BC, the prophet Amos receives some oracles from the Lord. We go to Amos chapter 1. They're interesting, the seven oracles, six of which begin for three transgressions and for four, and then they name what the transgressions are. And by saying that, it's underlying, these are persistent sins. It's not one or two, but it's three or four. They've kept sinning in the way they're being warned about through these oracles. So we read in Amos 1, verses 3 to 5. Thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Damascus and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because they have threshed Gilead with implements of iron. But I will send a fire into the house of Hazael, which shall devour the palaces of Ben-Hadad. I will also break the gate bar of Damascus, and cut off the inhabitants from the valley of Avon, and the one who holds the scepter from Beth Eden. The people of Syria shall go captive to Kir, says the Lord. And actually, as you read all the oracles, they all also contain, besides the three transgressions and for four, they also contain the words, I will send fire upon, and whatever it refers to in the oracle, which shall consume the palaces of, and again, depending on which oracle, that's repeated six times. Warning of coming judgment on the nations. If you go to Psalm 78, it talks about fire being the fires of war. War coming to the nations. In this prophecy of Amos, it talks about how they threshed Gilead. Again, if we were to jump about back in 2 Kings 10, it tells of how Syria is used to punish Israel. 2 Kings 13 then says the king of Syria had destroyed them and made them like the dust of threshing in his attack. What's going on here is that the Lord sent Syria to punish Israel. But like most of the nations who are sent in to punish Israel, they overdo it. And their cruelty far exceeds what God had intended. And so they, in their turn, have to suffer his judgment. Just out of interest, there is an obelisk in the British Museum, which was found in the palace of Nimrod in Syria. And it's described with the names of Hazael and Ben-Hadad of Syria, and also Jehu of Israel. And it just puts them into context that these kings, Syria, Israel, Judah, were actually all vassal states of the king of Assyria. And they were all paying him tribute. So they're squabbling among themselves and fighting among themselves, but actually they're all having to pay tribute to the greater power of Assyria. And that's what the obelisk says. You know, so it mentions these biblical names as historical figures and gives us an idea of their situation. Just as actually in one of the books, I think Velikovsky wrote, he talks about all the clay tablets which have been found between the king of Israel and the king of Egypt. And they plotted it. It was King Ahab of the Bible, who was actually his overlord for Egypt. And he spends all his time whinging about how the king of Egypt won't send him reinforcements, won't send him weapons, and all the time complaining about his lack of support, paying all this tribute, but getting nothing back. Anyway, Amos, The Valley of Avon, according to Josephus, the historian Josephus, was a delightful place, and Edom means pleasantness. So the ruler inhabitant of this pleasant land, it says, will be exiled to Kir. Actually, if you go on in Amos chapter 9, it says the Syrians come from Kir. So what God is saying, because of their sins, he's going to send them back where they came from. He allowed them to come into this pleasant land, this delightful land. But because of their sin, they will go back. Move forward again to 732 BC. And once again, Jerusalem is being besieged by Israel and Syria. So if we go to 2 Kings 16, 7 to 9. Now King Ahaz is on the throne of Jerusalem. And we read in 2 Kings 16, verse 7. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and save me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel, who rise up against me. And Ahaz took the silver and the gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house, and sent it as a present to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria heeded him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it, carried his people captive to Kir, and killed Rezin, which is a later Rezin from the one who originally conquered Damascus and set up that line of rulers. So there they are, the fulfillment of what Amos saw. The people are taken back to Kir by the king of Assyria. Isaiah 17, where we started, says that the kingdom will cease. Verse 3, the kingdom from Damascus. Damascus fell to Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, in 732 BC. From that time on, right up until the last century, Syria was never an independent nation. So the kingdom ceased at that point. That line of rulers was overthrown, disappeared. The people went back to Kir. Isaiah 17:2 says, the cities of Aroer are forsaken. Numbers tells us that Aroer is a city of Gad in the east, to the east of the Jordan. And 1 Chronicles 5:26 says that it was at this time when he conquered Damascus that Tiglath-Pileser took the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the tribe of Manasseh into captivity. They're the ones who lived beyond the Jordan. They decided in Goshen was such a lovely place to live. They wanted to settle there. And so they didn't go over with their other tribes into Israel. But they settled in that part of, over the other side of the Jordan Valley. And they were the first people to disappear. Tiglath-Pileser took them into captivity at that time. So was that prophecy of Isaiah actually fulfilled 700 years before Christ? And it's difficult for us to say. You know, it's one of those prophecies I would say could be ticked off and say, yes, that's been fulfilled. But it could still have a future fulfillment. I mentioned last time when we were talking about Iran, about Assyria, and how they just loved conquest. The records of most of the ancient civilizations do talk about battles, but they talk about their great achievements, how they built cities and aqueducts and irrigated land and produce more bounty for the people and so on. You know, Babylon did that. Other nations did that. But the Assyrians only leave one record for us, and that is war, 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 battle, 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 conquest, 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 kill, kill, kill. And so Tiglath-Pileser said, I destroyed 591 cities from the 16 districts of Damascus like ruins from the flood. So Isaiah wrote before this time. Is that fulfilled? Well, the question mark over it comes from the fact that we go forward another 150 years and we find there's another prophecy about Damascus. And this now comes from Jeremiah in 597 BC. If we go to Jeremiah 49, Jeremiah dates the prophecy for us, which is good. Against Damascus, this is 49:23. Against Damascus, Hamath and Arpad are shamed, for they have heard bad news. They are faint-hearted. There is trouble on the sea. It cannot be quiet. Damascus has grown feeble. She turns to flee, and fear has seized her. Anguish and sorrows have taken her like a woman in labor. Why is the city of praise not deserted, the city of my joy? Therefore her young men shall fall in her streets, and all the men of war shall be cut off in that day, says the Lord of hosts. I will kindle a fire in the wall of Damascus, and it shall consume the palaces of Ben-Hadad. The city of praise and joy. Damascus has always been famed for its beauty and its setting. It's set in a plain surrounded by mountains, and the ancient historians recorded how all round the city were gardens with fruit and orchards, and how pleasant a place it was, how lovely a place it was, the city of praise and joy, famed for its beauty. But Jeremiah sees a time when Damascus will be feeble and fire consumes her palaces. Now again, that could possibly have been fulfilled by Nebuchadnezzar, who took the city. But actually there's no historical evidence that it was. And we note the prophecy of Jeremiah is very similar to Amos. In Jeremiah 49:27, I will kindle a fire in the wall of Damascus, and it shall consume the palaces of Ben-Hadad. And Amos 1:4, but I will send fire into the house of Hazael, which shall devour the palaces of Ben-Hadad. And so he's quoting part of Amos, and he's almost saying there is a future fulfillment here. It hasn't been completed. There's something more. It may have seemed to have been completed when the Assyrians conquered the city, but no, there's more. It goes on in time. So in Jeremiah's time, there's still a future fulfillment of the destruction of Damascus. Although Damascus has been conquered many times, I don't believe it's actually ever been a ruinous heap. It's always been rebuilt after each conquest. And so we have a city which, after the Assyrians conquered it, then came the Babylonians and they ruled it for a time. Then the Persians ruled it. Then the Greeks came, and then the Romans came. The Romans rebuilt the city to their usual city town planning way. So they rebuilt the city. And then the Byzantine Empire ruled it, and then the Muslims came to Damascus in 634 AD. They came to what was then a largely Christian city, and various other Islamic dynasties followed. And Islamic rule ended in 1918, when Damascus fell to British and Arab forces. In all this time, Damascus has survived. There is still a street called Straight in Damascus, if you remember your Acts of the Apostles. It's there, not become a heap of ruins. So therefore, though one may possibly say there is a past fulfillment of this, I have to say there could well be a future fulfillment as well. And time will tell us on that one. So the question, will Damascus be destroyed before the coming of the Lord? And so we'll move on to the current situation. I mean, most of us, I'm sure we do watch television news, and we've seen the terrible destruction that's taken place in Syria since the beginning of this civil war. I mean, the films of Aleppo, and then later, well, currently, Eastern Ghouta. I mean, it's horrific what's happening to those cities. You know, has Syria got a future, we even ask. You know, it seems so thoroughly destroyed. It's a broken country. And the cost of restoring that nation is going to be vast after all that destruction. And even if it was restored, will the refugees ever want to return? A very familiar passage to us is Isaiah 11, which is a messianic passage. In Isaiah 11, verses 11 and 12, we read, "It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people who are left from Assyria and Egypt, from Pathros and Cush, from Elam and Shinar, from Hamath and the islands of the sea. He will set up a banner for the nations, and will assemble the outcasts of Israel to gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." Well, in Jeremiah, Hamath was also mentioned as part of Syria, which it is. And we know there has been a fulfillment of that prophecy in our day when the Jews have been restored from all these scattered lands into Israel. Prior to the middle of last century, Syria had one of the largest Jewish populations in the Middle East. After the Jews were driven from Spain in 1492, many of them went to Syria. And many of them established communities in Syria, and Damascus and Aleppo had huge Jewish populations. But during the 20th century, they've left, obviously, and there are very few Jews left now in Syria, in Hamath, as in that prophecy. Just got a report here about Syria. Well, a couple of reports. Just think about the consequences of that. I've got a heading, Syria and its threat to Israel. And we agree that it seems probable that Assad will regain control over most of Syria. Now he's won, no, since he's had the Russian support, things have turned in his favour. He's also supported by Iran and its ally Hezbollah. So a person called Bassam Tibbi, who's a secular Sunni scholar born in Damascus, has said that the Syrian conflict has been transformed into a sectarian religious war, adding that this core fact has been missed by many Western observers. Since the US invasion of Iraq in 2003, Iran has been filling the vacuum created by the removal of the former Iraqi leader, Saddam Hussein. Ever since, Iran has been expanding its power, explains Tibbi. Today, there are two blocs in the Middle East, the Sunni and the Shia blocs. The strongest bloc, even though Shias are the minority, is the Shia bloc. According to Tibbi, Iran is working with state and non-state actors to take over the region. The governments of Syria, Iraq and Lebanon are all under Tehran's control, while non-state armed groups such as Lebanon's Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen and the Shia militias of Iraq are also members of Tehran's radical alliance. Goes on to write, there's an axis of power coming from Iran to the Mediterranean and from Iran to Central Asia and from Iran to the Red Sea, said Tibbi. All the people who talk about the conflict in Syria do not acknowledge Iranian power. They do not acknowledge that the nature of the conflict is between Sunnis and Alawites, who are seen as an offshoot of Shia Islam. Looking ahead at the future, Tibbi stated a bleak picture, saying, Syria, my home country, is bleeding. There is a term to describe this conflict which cannot be solved. The diagnosis of the Syrian conflict is intractable. In the next 5 years, there will be no solution. Sunnis and Alawites and the protectors of the Alawites, the Iranians, cannot live together. But with the winding down of the civil war in Syria, the threat to Israel is now increasing. On February the 12th, MEMRI, which stands for the Middle East Media Research Institute, gave this report. A February the 9th, 2018 article on the pro-Hezbollah Lebanese website Dahir claims that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad recently rejected an Israeli demand relayed by Russian President Vladimir Putin to remove some 70,000 Iranian long-range missiles that Hezbollah has deployed throughout Syria and are aimed at Israel. The article claimed further that Syria and Hezbollah will wage a joint missile campaign against Israel and that Iranian experts are ready to launch missiles at Israel from every part of Lebanon and Syria. According to the article, Assad instructed his army to help Hezbollah construct and camouflage missile silos across the country. Moreover, the intense activity is underway to bring more Iranian missiles to Syria via Iraq, so that within a year, Hezbollah will have 500,000 missiles in Syria, in addition to the 150,000 is already deployed in Lebanon. This is the fruit of the Obama nuclear deal with Iran, which released vast sums of money, which the Iranian protests not long ago were all about the fact that all that money has been spent on supporting terrorists and buying weapons, and nothing has fed through for the benefit of the people. Anyway, carry on with the MEMRI report. And this is quoting the Hezbollah website. The enemy is now surrounded along 450 kilometers of its border by Hezbollah missiles and Iranian experts who are ready to fire these missiles into occupied Palestine from every part of Lebanon and especially from every part of Syria. Hezbollah wishes to expand its missile arsenal in Syria so that if the war lasts a long time, it will have large reserves of Iranian long-range missiles. That is why intense activity is underway along the Iran-Iraq-Syria route to transport Iranian missiles to Syria. Iran has over 2 million long-range missiles, and it's acting to provide Hezbollah with an arsenal of long-range missiles to be deployed throughout Syria. The missiles have a range of 1,100 kilometers and can reach occupied Palestine from every point of Syria. If the Israeli enemy remains idle and does not wage war for a year, Hezbollah will deploy 500,000 missiles on Syrian soil, in addition to its missiles in Lebanon, but especially throughout Syria, so that Israel's planes will find it difficult to target Hezbollah's bases there. Syrian President Dr. Bashar al-Assad has permitted the Arab Syrian army to extend every necessary assistance to Hezbollah, which is secretly digging underground missile silos in which to install missiles and automatic missile launchers. The silos will be equipped with large doors that rise to a height of 3 meters to allow the launch of a missile and then immediately close and lie flush with the ground so that Israeli planes cannot discover the site. Which of course then poses the question, with this huge threat, and memory is a reliable source, I believe, you know, if they've reported it, it's very likely to be true. How can Israel respond to this threat? Now, Israel has Iron Dome and Arrow and David Sling anti-missile systems, but each missile fired at Israel requires at least one missile to shoot it down, probably more because they don't always hit. You know, does Israel have 650,000 anti-aircraft missiles ready for deployment against such attack? Israel's only other means of defense is to target the launch sites with air attacks. And that's what happened recently in February. On the 9th of February, an Iranian drone entered Israeli airspace. The Israeli Air Force shot down the drone. And then the drone was launched from Tiyas military air base near Palmyra, Syria. It travelled through Jordanian airspace and was shot down by the Israeli Air Force over Israeli territory. But the incident prompted the Israeli Air Force to immediately attack Iran's command and control unit housed in the airbase. And that's the first time that Israel has attacked a manned Iranian base in Syria. During the attack, Syrian air defences managed for the first time to shoot down an Israeli aircraft. Shortly afterward, the Israeli Air Force retaliated by attacking a significant proportion of Syrian air defences, reportedly as high as 40 to 50% of them, as well as a few Iranian facilities in Syria. Apparently at that point Russia intervened to stop any further escalation. And so that's the problem now faced by Israel, a matter for prayer, obviously. If Hezbollah did launch an all-out attack on Israel, sending tens of thousands of missiles, could Israel contain it? Big question. Would Israel have to resort to its ultimate deterrent? We know it. They've been always cautious to admit it, that they have nuclear weapons. But, I mean, the scale of the threat is just unimaginable. 600,000 missiles launched rapidly into Israel. Hence the interest in the Isaiah prophecy. Will Damascus become a heap of rubble? We know the other prophecy we commented on already, that in Isaiah 19, verses 23, we read, "In that day there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrians will come into Egypt, and the Egyptians into Assyria, and the Egyptians will serve with the Assyrians. On that day Israel will be one of three with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the land." But to travel from Assyria to Egypt, you have to pass through Syria. So is that a hope that eventually people of Syria will be released and set free from the current trouble?